What's the secret behind passionate teams? Why are there only a few out there and how can we get more of them? If you've asked yourself these questions, then this podcast is for you. We are talking with national and international experts about passionate teams to answer these questions. This is our passion. This is what we are burning for. Welcome to the Passionate Teams Podcast. So welcome everybody to my podcast on passionate teams, this time with my first English episode. And I'm really, really happy that I have a really cool guest today. And this is Vasco Duarte, and I'm really happy that he's here with me. And Vasco, I would really ask that you just introduce yourself for a second.
Well, thank you, Mark. Also a fellow podcaster here on this side. I host the Scrum Master Toolbox podcast, on which Mark has been a guest already. So this is kind of a quid pro quo here. And if I have to introduce myself shortly, I would say that my real goal with the work that I do is to transform what we now call product development organizations, so like, you know, focusing on developing products and so on, into product business organizations. So because, I mean, my thinking is that the whole agile thing was just the beginning of an application of a philosophy of business, which is focusing on delivering constantly something valuable to the customer, getting the feedback and learning, right? And that for me is the most important. So I've played all kinds of roles like product manager, scrum master, project manager, director, agile coach, now a consultant or agile coach in quite a few industries, so not necessarily even in software. But for me, what is important is the end-to-end life cycle of the products and services that we have. So, you know, from concept to cash and back to concept and then back to cash and so on. So that we, you know, we create a wealthy society that solves real problems for the customers we try to get.
Okay. And some of my listeners may also know you from the No Estimate movement, right?
Yes, that is one of the one of the things that gets me shouted at on Twitter on a regular basis, even daily.
Okay. But still, I think it's a cool movement. I really like what's in there. And maybe the wording is not a perfect one, like no estimate. But yeah, I think some people just misunderstand what's behind there.
So definitely there's a misunderstanding in what no estimates means. But on the other hand, no estimates, the hashtag is something that attracted a lot of attention. So what that tells me is that people are clearly struggling with the use or the practice of estimation. And we need to find alternatives, which is the first phrase in the Agile Manifesto, right? I'm an Agile coach. I work with Agile organizations all the time. And the first phrase in the Agile Manifesto is that we are discovering or uncovering better ways of developing software. In my case, I would say delivering products by doing it and helping others do it. And estimation, it just doesn't work. So, of course, we need to start looking elsewhere. We need to start looking for alternatives. And that's what No Estimates is about.
Okay, cool. So we were just a bit off topic, but doesn't matter. I would really go dive into now the topic of passionate teams, which is also maybe one of my passions at the moment. I'm really looking for what's in there, how can I get there to the state, and what are the tools I can use for getting there. And the first question I have to use, how would you define a passionate team?
So I would say that you can't look for passion by looking at the team. When you look at the outcome of their work, at the quality of the product or services that the team produces, as seen by their customers, you will know if it's a passionate team. You will know it because passion exudes in the product, the outcome or the final deliverable that comes out of a passionate team. You will see it in the quality of the products that they produce. And you know, just before we started recording, we were talking about two different kinds of microphone, right? The one that you're using right now, which sounds awesome. And another one, which is driven by what I would call a marketing-focused American company who doesn't understand the use of their technology.
Okay. So you would say these guys are not passionate about what they're doing?
Or I would say that the guys who build the microphone you are using are definitely passionate. We can hear it in the quality of the sound that comes out of that microphone.
Yeah, I think these guys are really passionate about it. That's true, yeah. Okay, so you define more or less, if we have a cool product that works flawlessly and it has a good human, human interface or easy to use, whatever, then you would say there's always a passionate team behind.
Well, it doesn't need to be easy to use necessarily. It depends on what kind of product we are talking about. But in the case of a microphone that is used for recording in a, you know, like, for example, the microphone I'm using, it's used for recording anywhere. It's not used for recording in a studio, right? So you need to deal with all kinds of other sound problems. And you see that people are actually thinking about how the product is going to be used, and they transfer that into the product itself. It doesn't need to be an easy-to-use product. It can be a very complex, spectrometer or whatever. Like, it doesn't need to be something that is easy to use, but it clearly helps the people using it to solve a real problem that they have. And it does so very often in ways that are very hard to replicate because they required a lot of passion to develop that kind of a product.
Okay. So this would lead me to my next question. Did you ever work in such a passionate team building such a product?
Yes, I did.
I need more details.
No, I thought you would need more details. So this was a team that started a new business, completely new business for a company. And at first, we were only 4 developers and myself. I was the product owner. Later on, we were 5 developers, 1 designer, 2 testers. And we created the product in a different way, right? What we were trying to do was to enter a new market area. And instead of sitting down and having this roadmap discussions that most of the listeners will probably be familiar with, right? Like top management discussions where the outcome is a roadmap with a list of features and whatever. We actually just sat down, we decided what's the minimum thing that we need to give to these customers and started working on that. And then at the same time, I went around the world visiting customers, seeing them in action and asking them what were the problems that they were trying to solve already, right? Not what they wanted to solve in the future, but what they were already trying to solve at that time. And through that, we evolved the product. The product became something we didn't imagine at the beginning, right? Of course, we had some ideas and there were a lot of options as to what the product could be, but the product evolved in co-creation with the customers and with people that were really all the time, they were trying to take the barrier, the level of the quality of the product to the next level. And we had lots of arguments, we had discussions, but in the end, we loved the work that we were doing. And we could see that in the product that we were delivering because it was very well accepted. It solved the problems that the customers were actually solving. And the most important metric for me, it became a viable business. We grew that product from €0 in revenue to €10 million in revenue per year in less than 4 years.
So maybe you can give us listeners a hint what product you're talking about.
So this was a corporate or enterprise level management mm-hmm. product for security endpoints. So as you can see, not very sexy in the description, but the customers loved it. The users of the endpoints, the points, you know, the laptops and mobile phones that we were trying to secure, were happy about it because they weren't bothered about it, right? But the people who own the security of those devices, the corporations and ISPs or internet service providers, they loved it because it solved a real problem for them. It created market and business opportunities for them. And that's for me, that's the hallmark of a passionate team is a team that understands that what they are there to do is to deliver something that creates more value, that generates value in the world, not just a product. And that's why in my bio, I say that I want to transform product development organizations into product business organizations, because we are here and businesses survive because we want to help other people solve problems that they have.
Okay, so what was then your secret, you would say? Okay, why was it so successful? Why did you get such a passionate team? So what was your secret in this team?
So I've thought a lot about it. Obviously, there's a few things that I will highlight as kind of key points. But I want to say that this is now an analysis done after the fact. So I can't really say for sure what really started it, but I can talk about the symptoms or the signs that things were really working well. So, for example, everyone in that team wanted to succeed. They didn't look at that as their daily job. They weren't trying to do a 9-to-5. Now, I can't say that this was a cause. It might have been a consequence of something else, but that I saw that, right? I saw people staying late some days and, of course, leaving early other days. It exuded, the whole team exuded this drive to succeed, this drive to have something created with their time and knowledge that was valuable for people out there. So this drive to succeed, I would definitely put as one of the signs. And then the other sign is something that came from the interaction of the team members. And you know, when we talk about passionate teams and teams that are, you know, succeeding and well working, you know, gelling, as the term would be, one would say that they're probably working well without conflict. Well, actually, in my experience, the best teams I've worked with, there's conflict. And you sometimes when you're an outsider, you might even think that they are fighting with each other. Right? But they are not. Yeah. What they are trying to do, the process they are going through, is this constructive conflict whereby ideas are the focus of their discussion, not the people. It's not about your idea versus my idea, but it's about multiple ideas and which one should we try and how do we develop it. And so on. And in the end, out of those conflicts emerged other ideas that no one in that meeting or conversation ever thought about before, but they were developed and further improved with, you know, multiple perspectives, and together as a team, they created something new. So this constructive conflict is definitely one of the most important things that I would say you would see in a high-performing or a passionate team, if you will.
So what you said now was that really it's about passionate people, if one thing you would say. These people are really passionate. And the second thing was it's also about diversity, especially diversity in mindset, right? Different opinions sometimes, maybe from different directions coming, different people.
Well, so I would say that a team, you know, if it's more than two people, and even in two people that could happen, a team is a complex social system. In my experience, you can't remove diversity from a social system. What you can do is that you can quench it. You can stop it from emerging, right? And this is very much done. I'm thinking about Germany, the country we both lived in. You still live there, where the opinion of the boss is always the one that matters, right? And that's one way to constrain a social system. In order to create order, there's a reason for it, but that does not remove the diversity in those teams. It just stops it from being expressed. And I would say that in passionate teams, there is an environment where diversity can be expressed, where it's okay to disagree. And actually, in fact, we look for opportunities for disagreement, not to fight, although it might look like fighting from the outside, but rather to learn, right? And when we get into a discussion and we start, you know, arguing, even when we put arguments, then we learn, because we have to express unstated assumptions that we had. And we have to listen to other assumptions that may be different than ours. And, you know, that's my hypothesis, at least, that you can't remove diversity from a complex system. You just need to find ways to let it emerge.
Yeah, that's true. And that's maybe, yeah, you're right. It's maybe sometimes a problem in German culture. Fortunately, there are people changing in this area, but still, this is, yeah, the usually the boss says in which direction we are moving and going, and then he's really putting a stop maybe on some of these discussions. That's right. And I just recently read a book from Simon Sinek. It's called Together is Better. It's a really tiny book. And one thing he explained was in there, if you're in a team and there is maybe some guys that are not that long in the company and they have a cool idea, what could they change and maybe some adapt some stuff. And then some other guys are telling them, come on, we are now really, really long in this company. We know how this is running here. So we have more experience. And we've done this now for 10 years. So we will do it. We will continue doing it like that. And then he writes in his book, if you hear something like that, then run. Run fast.
Well, that's not a very passionate team, right? If that's how they behave.
That's right. Yeah, that's true. That's right. But I liked it a lot. It's really like, yeah. Reminds me on the story I was listening to on it in the children's book. It's a really famous person. It's Benjamin Blümchen in German. I don't know if you know Benjamin Blümchen. Do you know him? No. Maybe because your children were also in German. But yeah, this is a speaking elephant. Yeah. And he's one day he comes to the hospital and the same thing happened. And then we did it always like that before. We won't change. It's really, so this is really following myself already for years since I was a child.
Yeah, and I actually there's one perhaps another characteristic of a passionate team is that they don't accept external constraints. They embrace, but then they change external constraints. Like, for example, in this particular team that I was working with, we introduced Scrum. Right. And in Scrum, there's this thing that, you know, you do the sprint planning in the beginning and then you do the planning poker and so on. And this team just stopped estimating. They took in the Scrum constraint of doing the planning and the estimation and so on. And then at some point they decided, hey, this is not useful for us anymore. We'll stop it. Another thing that they did is that they had the Jira board, right, where they had all of the stories that they were working on. And at some point, they said, this is not useful for us. We should use a physical board. They were co-located, so that was easy for them. And they started using a physical board. And then later on, we changed rooms. We went to another room in another part of the building, and they designed the room themselves. And the room, if you enter that room, you would say, these guys are crazy. It looked totally different from a normal room in that company. Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't mean mm-hmm. that their design was better. It meant, in my perspective, that they were okay with taking in constraints from the outside, but changing them when necessary. And this ability to own how you work and to develop it further, which is so big in Agile, although not very commonly seen, is definitely a marker of a passionate team, is that they feel that they own how they work. They don't delegate that to other people, like their manager.
Yeah, I totally agree with this one. For me, a passionate team is a team which just moves. And if something is in the way, they just remove it. So, and that's what you can really see. When you have bigger companies where they have really strict processes and so on with state gates and all these stuff, right? So they will find ways around it to be able to still deliver in the end, right? Because they are so passionate about what they are doing, they try to embrace what's around them, but also to adapt and to change and to still be able to deliver in the end. And it's also something I can see a lot in passionate teams. Interesting. So how would you say some bosses or leaders are important if you want to have a passionate team? What role do they play?
Yeah, so there's this, in most organizations that are big enough will have some sort of hierarchy, right? And hierarchy, if we go back to the original, development of the idea of the chain of command and hierarchy and so on, we know that it has to do with making certain decisions at the higher level while leaving other decisions to be done by the people in the lower level of the hierarchies. Now, in the corporate world, we have misunderstood that by always pushing decisions upwards. And that's typically the role that many managers and leaders take, getting the decisions the teams don't want to do on their own. And for me, that is anathema, that is contrary to the creation of a passionate team. Because how can you be passionate about something on which you have no decision power, right? And we're talking about products in the case of product development organizations, services in the case of service organizations, and so on. I mean, we have these amazing examples of companies that delegate the decision about making the customer happy to the lowest level of the organization, right? Like Nordstrom, the department store. There's a whole book about it. I think it's called Radical Management by Steve Denning, where he talks about putting the client first, the customer first in everything we do. And the way to do that is to actually delegate the decision-making to the fringes of the organization, because those are the people who are actually in touch with the quote-unquote reality of what it is to work with clients, to be in front of clients every day when they are at work. So for me, the role of the leader is someone who enables the people who do the real work, who solve the real problems in product development, who develop the real product, to be able to make decisions. Now, what does that mean? In very practical terms, it means that the product owner is not a person outside the team. I shudder to think and to hear when people in Scrum say that the product owner is not a team member. That is the most ridiculous idea I've ever heard in my career. Of course, the product owner is part of the team. Otherwise, the team has no ownership over the product. Right? By definition, if you put the product owner outside the team is just a bunch of lackeys, servants to the product owner. That makes absolutely no sense. The team is the most creative, intelligent group to develop the product, right? So I would say that leaders need to create the environment, for example, making the product owners part of the team, getting the developers to actually talk to and interact with customers, real customers, right? That kind of actions, that's there for the leader. The leader in a passionate team is constantly working on creating the environment that allows the team to express their creativity and their ingenuity every day.
And why do you think this is not happening more often? When you look around, I think you have visited a lot of companies, me too, and what you always see is something the completely opposite, right? Somebody on the top and he's taking all the decisions, and then some teams that are not really passionate about what they're doing. So why do you believe not more bosses are out there are really going direction of delegating more of this things down to those levels?
Unfortunately, it takes a lot of positive reinforcement to get people to make decisions and take ownership on their own. And the reason for that is that somewhere in their history, in their past, they worked for a boss who didn't allow them to make decisions and punish them. And if you look at it from that perspective, it makes perfect sense for most teams to actually stop making decisions on their own, because they are reliving the punishment they got when once, as juniors, for example, they were punished by a senior colleague or a leader for taking initiative. The worst thing we can do to a team is to punish them when they take initiative and they fail. This is the same as us telling a child that is just learning how to walk, right? You know, whatever, 6 months or so, learning how to walk. And you know what we do with children, with babies like that, right? They get up, they take two steps, and everybody goes like, yeah, great, you can do it, that's brilliant. Well, when we go to work and somebody tries to do that, we shoot them down. Right? We punish them. Yes, we humiliate them. We make them an example to the others. Of course we're going to be afraid.
Yeah, this also means there's still a lot of work to do to get these people again into this, okay, I will take two steps now. Yeah.
Exactly.
Because they still will have this fear. This is also some of the work we have to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And if we look at the five dysfunctions of a team, this anti-pattern that I just described is it kills the trust from the team to their seniors or leaders. And it also creates a fear of conflict, because you can't win, right? Like, if there's a problem, you get punished as a team. And of course, that drives the next dysfunction, the lack of commitment. if there's no way I can win, why should I play? Right? And that drives the fourth dysfunction, which is the avoidance of accountability. I'm not playing, so don't make me responsible for the success of the product. You are, dear leader or boss. And obviously, at some point, we don't really care about the results anymore. And these are all of the five dysfunctions of a team that Patrick Lencioni talks about in the Five Dysfunctions of a Team book, which are, if you see those in your team, you can be absolutely sure you will not have a passionate team. If you still have it now, in a couple of weeks, it will be gone. Because those dysfunctions destroy the ability for the team to grow as a group of individuals.
Yeah, I totally agree on this one. So when we already talk about negative stuff, what would be, or what is the most negative experience you had in your past where you could really see, oh, either as a team member or maybe in some other role where really the passion of the team was killed right from the beginning?
Yeah, so I, in this particular case, this actually happened to the team that I think was the best team I worked with. And it was a demo. We were all together and looking at the software that the team had delivered. And during the sprint, we had a problem with designing a new feature that we were supposed to deliver in that sprint. And we didn't really understand the problem properly. We couldn't kind of get the grasp at what was the original problem that drove the product owner and the customers to ask for that feature. And as we went through the demo, the team showed themselves, right? So there wasn't a leader showing it for the team. But the team themselves, they showed the feature and they already knew they were going to get slack on it. They were going to be punished, so quote unquote. So, you know, there would be some verbal abuse, as I would call it, because of that. But anyway, as a team, they took the decision to anyway demo the feature, and they demoed the feature. And of course, no surprise, after the demo, one of the guys, a boss, an outsider, right, who had an interest in the result of the team, started verbally abusing them. This is not how we work. We can't do it this way. You guys did this wrong. I want to have better plans next time. And this is just one example of how easy it is to just fall back into those punishment anti-patterns that we have in organizations that are highly hierarchical and therefore kill the passion in the team.
Yeah, unfortunately, really bad. So now that already time is running, and what I would like to ask you as a final thing is, what would be a final word, final sentence you would tell my listeners regarding passionate teams? What can they do in their workplaces?
Well, so first of all, I think that you should all read the blog post that Mark published on the passion model, and hopefully at some point even the book. But that's not enough. What I would say is that once you understand the model and once you understand those characteristics that Mark describes, then it's time to go back to basics. Passionate teams are created on the day-to-day practice of creating amazing, hyper-performing, really passionate teams. Passionate teams do not fall from the sky. They are not an accident, and they are not created by magic tools either. They are created by constant, you know, daily endeavor, effort, reflection, just like the Agile Manifesto says. And I would say that I like to use this quote in Scrum specifically. Of course, this is not true only for Scrum, but in Scrum specifically, we have two outcomes for the work of a Scrum Master. One is whatever the team produces. It's the, you know, helping the team to deliver the right product, to interact with the stakeholders in the right way, to understand how to grow that business that I was talking about in the beginning. So that's outcome or product number one. And of course, product number two is actually the one that creates the possibility of getting product number one, which is to create an amazing, passionate team, to create the environment that allows the team to take ownership, get the stakeholders involved that can bring in the customer view, and if possible, get the people in the team to actually talk and you know, spend time with customers, listening to their struggles and their problems. So those really are the two things that we should be focusing on, is the business we're working on and the teams that enable our business to be successful.
Thank you, Vasco. Really, really good final words. And it was a pleasure talking to you. And I hope I will see you soon someday. And you are currently not quite far away, but I think we'll find ways to get together again.
Absolutely. We'll get you to a conference.
Yeah. Thank you, Vasco.
Thank you, Mark.
Bye.